We had heard a bit about from the implementation group earlier in our work, and some time has passed, so we thought it'd be worthwhile, particularly since we would be in the same place, to see where that work stands now. So we've got Mike Zupke, Amy Bivens, who we've spoke with the last time, and Danielle Andela. With us for the first time, I think. So I'll turn it over.
Difficulties. Okay, so this presentation is just following up on the presentation that Mike gave to you guys about a month ago now, and we just wanted to go through some different contracting models that we're familiar with the staff and that we're using to kind of frame our thinking about privacy, proxy, accreditation, implementation, and how it might work. Basically, today I'm just going to talk about three different contracting models that ICANN uses right now, and talk about some of the issues that we've thought about that could come up in implementation of a privacy proxy accreditation program, and questions that we would have, and things that would be good to think about. So the three different contracting models are the registrar accreditation model, which everyone's pretty familiar with, the reseller model, and also the escrow agent model that's being used a lot now by the registry services team. So the registrar contracting model, as most of you know, is that, you know, when someone wants to become a registrar, they fill out an application to ICANN and pay the application fee. And then staff review the application, approve the application, you know, vet the people, do a background check, and screen the answers to the questions. And then eventually, if and when staff is satisfied with the application, eventually the registrar and ICANN enter to the RAA. So it's a contract between the registrar and ICANN. And the reseller contracting model, which is another one that you guys are probably familiar with, is instead of a reseller going to ICANN, they go to a registrar and select a registrar, multiple registrars that they wish to work with, and follow the registrar's processes for entering into a reseller agreement. And the reseller agreement has some terms that are mandated under the registrar accreditation agreement, but the remainder of the terms are set by the registrar, so the registrar has control over the various terms of the agreement beyond what's required under the RAA. So the escrow agent contracting model is in some ways kind of a hybrid between the two, and the escrow agent identifies a sponsoring entity. In this case, it would probably be a registrar, but in practice right now, it's a registry for the most part, and finds a registry or a registrar that they want to work with. And then once they've found one, they submit an application to ICANN, and then ICANN reviews the application and then sends it back to the registrar and the escrow agent to negotiate a contract, decide on the terms of the agreement, and then ICANN ultimately has to approve the contract. And ICANN isn't a party to the contract, but it's a beneficiary to the contract, so it has some rights under the contract. Because these contracts are among different parties,
The escrow agent, is that for backing up data? Or what is, okay.
Yes. It's becoming more common now. It's pretty popular with the new GTLDs program, with the agreements between new registries and escrow agents.
So it's solely for the purpose of backing up data? Because escrow agent can mean a lot of things.
Yeah.
So this is Mike. You know, just as a little bit further kind of clarification on this, So registrars have an option to use the agent that ICANN has designated and pays for, which is currently Iron Mountain, or they have the option to select what we call a third-party provider. Registries really only have the one option, and that's to find their own provider and then have that approved by ICANN. So most of what you'll see in the slide is referring to what we do in the registrar model, and the reason is that in the registrar model, it's ICANN has an agreement with the registrar and the escrow agent. So it's a little bit cleaner in some regards for at least discussion purposes about how enforcement works and that sort of thing.
But my understanding of the escrow model is that it's essentially that registrars can choose any escrow provider they want, but they have because the Iron Mountain has already been certified by ICANN, they have a financial incentive to, it's easier basically. So there's some incentive to use that. That's true.
Someone go back to that slide again, because the purpose of the slide was to show us that ICANN was a party to the escrow agent agreement. Is that? Okay, I think I get it.
So that was kind of this is Mike again, that was sort of the point that I was making, was that in the registrar arrangement, ICANN is a party to the agreement. In the registry arrangement, ICANN is a beneficiary to the agreement. And you know, the distinction between the two is a little bit, you know, beyond my comprehension. But, you know, and that's why I say for discussion here, we're really talking about the registrar model for the most part.
Thanks, Mike. Okay, so with respect to these different models, one of the big differences between some of them is just how they're enforced. When you know, something comes up, and for example, like if a service is not following the terms of the agreement, how enforcement works. And so in the registrar model, only ICANN can enforce the terms of the contract. And the enforcement mechanism is it's a legal enforcement, not necessarily a specific performance type enforcement. Whereas with the reseller model, ICANN, through the registrar, and also the registrar have enforcement capability. The way that ICANN has enforcement power through the reseller model is through the RAA. And a registrar could also be required, potentially in the privacy proxy context, if it were applied ultimately here. A registrar could be required to act on privacy proxy service complaints like they do for abuse complaints now in the reseller model. And in the escrow agent model, like the reseller model, both ICANN and the registrar have enforcement capabilities. So
this is Mike again. I just thought we can also offer in between these slides, if there are questions, we're happy to,
yes,
you know, to be interrupted. Yeah, please go ahead.
I think what you're saying, is the enforcement is through a contract, and what you're saying is the contract is the RAA, and the enforcement is that the ICANN has the ability to say to the registrar, we have a contract with you and you are not complying with it. Now, that can be the only way that this is enforced, because third-party beneficiary can't enforce something. So it has, I'm understanding that's the way the enforcement happens?
Yes.
Thank you.
Right. And so, you know, the distinction here, can you go back a slide?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So, Mike again. You know, the distinction here is in the registrar model, ICANN can directly enforce its agreement against the registrar. And if you replace the word registrar with proxy service, it's the same thing. ICANN can say to the proxy service, you're in breach, you know, and there could be potentially, you know, penalties for failure to comply, or ICANN could terminate the agreement. In the reseller model, and when, you know, the proxy or privacy service could operate the same way, ICANN goes to the registrar and says, in your registrar accreditation agreement, it says that you will require, you know, your reseller or your proxy service to do the following things. If your privacy or proxy service fails to do the things that are in there, we can hold you, registrar, responsible for failing to enforce your agreement. In the escrow agent model, and this is why I say, you know, we can sort of set aside the third party thing, because what we're really talking about is a three party agreement in this instance. And so either ICANN or the registrar could enforce compliance, at least, you know, from a legal perspective, against the what would be the proxy service if there were an issue of breach.
I wouldn't say so much a three-party agreement as it says an agreement that's enforceable, but really against one of the two parties based on another contract. really.
Did you have a question, James? Or a comment?
Question or comment, or however you want to phrase it. Also, welcome Volker. If anybody didn't see him, I didn't see him sneak in, maybe. I just want to point out that from the registrar perspective, the pull-through model of enforcing contractual obligations by proxy on proxy service providers through a separate agreement is problematic, particularly when they're delivering different services. It's bad enough when a reseller is delivering the exact same service that the registrar is and just marking it up and targeting a different market. This is a different service model altogether. And as a registrar with millions of customers, to have all of them, really all of them, at risk of what our worst reseller could possibly do is not an acceptable framework. So I would say, and we had this conversation a month ago, and I think you guys heard this feedback from us, this mechanism of we're going to build this privacy proxy accreditation framework under the RAA and punt that enforcement responsibility to registrars and just hit them with our RAA stick when they fail, that's not acceptable to us. That's not what the EWG said. That's not what the Who Is Review team said, and that's not what the community said. So I don't understand why this is still on the table as a model here, if it's maybe just for academic reasons. But I really think that we should not be going down that path. Thanks.
Thanks, James. Mike again. So, you know, we took what you said to heart last time, you know, and we went through the record for the Who Is Review team and went through, you know, their recommendations and what was said about this. And so, you know, our read of that was that there was sort of a presumption that there's a certain way that accreditation works, but I don't think that it necessarily said, you know, you're confined to one path to doing it. So when we present this, what we're trying to do is we're trying to show you sort of the range of possible options that, you know, that we could proceed down. And so, you know, we're not really of the opinion that that was necessarily foreclosed. And while we're not saying that we're, you know, set on doing it that way, you know, we're kind of, this session is to give everybody kind of the full sense of options and also the information about that. And I think that, as you'll see as Amy goes on, some of the considerations in this might favor that model over others, and in particular, not to you know, sort of jump the gun, but when we talk about how we do transitions of a terminated entity, a terminated proxy service, you know, there's scenarios where there could be more friction in the process, which, you know, we sort of equate to more risk, more potentially, I don't want to say lost registrations, but more you know, lost privacy, or so to speak, or you know, there could indeed actually be lost registrations in the process, and that they exist, but who the underlying customer is might be unknown. But so, you know, we're still kind of in this state of trying to, you know, figure out how to do the balance. And it's not a matter of a decision having been made. This is really about trying to present all of the considerations to you. And I don't know if people have had a chance to look at that chart. I think that, you know, it was probably a couple pages, and it's in the middle of a lot of other stuff going on. But, you know, that's kind of, if you want the sneak peek, the chart that Mary sent around about, I don't know, what is it, about a week ago, week and a half ago, that's really, you know, where this is coming from. So there's a little bit more detail in that than what you see on the slides, just if it's helpful to anybody.
Wendy.
Thanks. Wendy Seltzer here. And just one notable feature of this sort of whole contractual enforcement structure is sort of the lack of the party who is ultimately affected by registering domains under it. And, you know, we could address that by putting third-party beneficiary rights into these agreements, and in the past ICANN has tended sort of explicitly to try to deny that, since we are regulating the rights available to end-user registrants, it would be good to address where they could stake stronger claims to enforce their interests.
Sorry. thanks, Wendy. I mean, that's a good point. I think that may even be an issue for this group in that it's really what you're talking about is the customer of the proxy or privacy service, what is their recourse? So, you know, I don't necessarily see that exclusively as an implementation issue.
Any other questions before we move on? Okay. So one of the other considerations that we wanted to compare these different models for was termination. And under the registrar model, terminations require a lot of coordination among all the parties. And as Mike said, could potentially involve the greatest risk. In the registrar context, when an RAA is terminated, all registrations are bulk transferred to another registrar via the registries. And in the event that a privacy proxy service would be terminated, it could be more complicated because ICANN would need exceedingly current registration data, which sometimes is hard to get. And the registrar of record would need to be the one to do the change of the registered name holder, which could require changes to the registration agreements themselves. And if ICANN chooses or recommends a new gaining privacy proxy service in some cases, this might force a registrar to do business with a privacy proxy service or registrant that they don't necessarily want to do business with. And that's just one of the issues that we thought about that we wanted to point out. In the reseller model, ICANN could potentially create some sort of standardized termination procedure that a registrar could follow in the event that a privacy proxy service is terminated, or allow some flexibility for registrars to decide how they want to handle that situation. And in the escrow model, as with the reseller model, ICANN could create some sort of standardized procedure or allow flexibility, or ICANN could affect the termination itself.
So this is Mike again. I feel like, you know, we kind of, despite the, you know, the good explanation, I feel like we went through the slide kind of quickly. So I don't know if this group has thought through a lot about termination. I'm sorry that I don't follow as actively as as Amy and others do. But, you know, if it would be helpful, we could talk more about sort of how we think that process would work. But if everybody's got it, then I don't mean to belabor the point either. Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
This is Steve Metallitz. I had a separate a question about another dimension of this, which I was trying to figure out how these different models would work in a situation in which, first, you have the situation in which this, the proxy service is essentially a subsidiary of the registrar. That's seems to be the case with all those that are participating in this working group. It's not the case of every proxy service. But how would this work in a situation when it's an independent proxy service provider? In other words, would it work differently through these different models in that case? Because you mentioned one might lead to a situation in which a registrar would be doing business with a proxy service provider that it didn't want to do business with. The RAA says you can only do, once an accreditation program is in place, I think this is what it says, once an accreditation program is in place, you can only do business with an accredited proxy service provider, but it doesn't speak to whether you have to do business with all accredited proxy service providers. Do any of these models make any difference on that question?
So this is Mike again. We, for the sake of the analysis, you know, we sort of were thinking in terms of exposing where is the most potential either divergence between the models or where is the most potential risk in any of these models. We assumed that there is not a relationship between the registrar and the privacy or proxy service. So as we go through these, you know, that might be a little bit more evident as we get kind of into like the impact on registrar slide and the impact on customers. But, you know, that – that does create some real challenges. So, in the instance where the registrar and the proxy service is accredited, are affiliated, in the event that there's any sort of an issue, the registrar is sort of a de facto backstop. You don't have that when there's no affiliation, and as we'll get to in this registrar model, that's one of the risks that we see is potentially. There's one entity that kind of controls the ability to relay or reveal data if they're the only one who has it. And the same thing in the event of termination, they're the only one who can tell you exactly who their customers are or what data has been escrowed. So, it is one of the reasons why I think the second or third models we've described have a little bit more appeal in some ways is that they seem to deal better with the potential transaction that isn't between affiliated parties, the registrar and the proxy service. Yeah, go ahead, James.
Right. Saying me? Okay. Question I was wondering about is, and maybe this touches on it, is how are registrars going to include the underlying customer data for an unaffiliated privacy service in their escrow deposits, because they are required to do so?
So I think there are probably a couple ways of dealing with that. And we're getting into really, I think, part of the more complicated areas of implementation. But, one possibility would be, we just impose a requirement that says everybody who's a proxy service has to give the data to the registrar. And I know, Volker, I think, has raised, some issues with that in some jurisdictions that may offend, their privacy laws. So, there might either be an alternative to that or maybe we just throw that option out. We say there's got to be another way of escrowing data, either, that service escrows it with, a similar arrangement that we have right now with Iron Mountain and other escrow agents, or maybe we come up with an independent escrow sort of service. And obviously, there's cost involved in doing that.
But the reason I ask in the context of this is that depending on the model that we choose, we may need to go back and amend that requirement in the RAA. Because if the privacy proxy service is escrowing it separately, then the registrar would only be obligated to escrow that data if they were as an affiliated service.
Yeah, I'll have to think more about what the specific requirement is in the RAA, because I'm not sure, which part of it comes from the specification that's being replaced and which part of it comes from 3.6 and 3.4, that which deal with the data escrow requirements. So I think we'll have to probably take that one back and get back to you and put some more thought into it.
Just a question, I suppose, a follow-on. In terms of compliance, you would be using the RAA with a registrar to enforce requirements about the privacy proxy service provider. What are you going to do if the privacy proxy service provider is closely affiliated with the registrar? Surely the registrar is in breach of the contract, and surely you'd be taking action against the registrar, not the privacy proxy servers. That's all you can do.
Right, and I think it's almost by design.
James is taking note.
Excuse me. Phil Corwin for the record. Do we have data on the current breakdown? My sense up to this moment has been that the majority of domains under privacy proxy protection are using a service that's affiliated, that's a subsidiary of a registrar. That maybe I'm wrong on that, but the only representation of privacy proxy service providers in this group is from registrars. It's certainly easier for the registrant to choose to add that service at the time of registration rather than to seek out a third-party provider. So the fact that you haven't factored that in, I think that may be the majority of providers. Also, we're envisioning, I assume, whether the provider is or is not, is affiliated with a registrar or is a third-party provider, that my assumption has been that ICANN will be the one accrediting them. Therefore, ICANN would be the one de-accrediting them if they run afoul of their, if they're not complying with the requirements that they've agreed to comply with to be accredited. So are we all on the same page, and do we have that data about what the current breakdown is? Is that data out there?
So this is Mike again. I'm not aware that the data is out there, and I would think if anybody's got it, this working group would. I would think that's relevant to, you know, the work that you're doing, and it's probably not, you know, readily obtainable. But you know, your point is well taken about, you know, most registrants are probably buying the service, the proxy service, the privacy service at the time of registration, whether that's from their registrar or their reseller. That you know, intuitively, that makes sense. That's probably the normal scenario. We are aware, though, of proxy services that seem to be sort of independently run, where a person can, you know, discover there's a proxy service out there, and sometimes they're even offered free. All they have to do is change their, you know, their WHOIS data, what this is, and you know, just register. And so, you know, those services do exist, and you know, to my mind, those are probably the ones that have the most risk associated with them. They probably involve the least amount of, you know, sort of safeguards at the registrar or reseller level. And also, you know, I think that there's a risk involved that people are probably unaware of who are using them, and that's that, you know, if their proxy service, who they have really no strong connection to, disappears, their domain name could disappear with it. So I think, you know, I mean, I think it's an interesting point. I don't know if it necessarily changed the analysis, because we know that those services are out there, though. And the second question was, I already forgot what the second question was, sorry.
Just to fill again for the transcript, just two quick comments. One, I think if we don't have the total data, we probably could survey some aggregate representative sample of WHOIS data just to see how many are under, you know, where the registrant is listed as one of the well-known proxy providers. But I'd be suspicious of anyone offering this for free. It reminds me of back in 2007 when I had just recently got involved with ICANN, the RegisterFly situation, where the company was offering free privacy proxy protection, and in fact the CEO was registering all those domains in his own personal name. It became a huge mess. So, and I'd be suspicious of any third-party provider doing anything for free. You know, why would they be doing that for free? Because it involves some work and some responsibility. You know, and it's normal for companies offering a service to want to make money doing it. So, how are they making their money if they're not charging the registrant? But I'll stop there.
So three things. One, I do have that entire data set. I've also figured out how to solve the freshwater problem of Southern California, and I'm going to share none of it with any of you. But no, yeah, right. I don't have that data set. I wanted to ask a really stupid question, which you've already partially answered, which is, how would it work? I mean, how would an unaffiliated privacy service work? We don't envision a world where I can go to GoDaddy, and maybe we do envision this world, I don't know, where I can go to GoDaddy, and because other people have qualified as an accredited privacy proxy service, then GoDaddy has to list them, and I check which one I want. Well, I don't understand how an independent accredited, not that's scary people that we're talking about, but an accredited business, how would that even work? How would the registrant be able to access that, and how would the accredited privacy service actually know that that's happened, short of, you know, watching new registration lists and pulling out from that new registration list? And then thirdly, just to give you guys a pep talk, if you think that we're reacting sort of unexcitedly, we apologize, but you guys are talking about, like, how to get off at the station, and we're still the committee of trying to buy the ticket, right? And so we're way behind this. So it's not you, it's us.
Thanks, Paul. I think James is going to answer the question about how it works, but I want to say I'm happy to, you know, depart my terminal here and wait for you guys to get to the station.
See, I thought we were the committee on how to build a train. You're way
I'd be
ahead
happy,
of
I'd be happy with tickets. A piece of track. Just a piece of track.
Yeah. Yep. The short answer is, and this is just shooting from the hip here, is that a privacy service would be a reseller of multiple registrars, and that the transaction would start with the privacy service instead of had it added on at the end of a transaction. It would start there, and then the domain registration would be the add-on.
Sorry,
did I just invent something on the public record?
Damn it.
I told you it was a stupid question, so thank you.
Well, right now, the path and the way it has traditionally been done, and I will acknowledge that I think that the industry has just kind of gravitated around this standard, which is that the registration begins, pick your domain name, search for it, we send it to you, you add it to your cart, and by the way, would you like this to be private, and that's added on at the end. Presumably, an independent service would say something like, start the transaction with the privacy service, tell us what name you want, we will go... Because we are a reseller of multiple registrars, we will go and find you the most appropriate registrar, or the most best deal, whatever. And then the registration comes after the enrollment in the privacy service. So it just turns the transaction upside down. Right, and that's where you manage it.
Yeah, just to further confuse the situation, do we need to create a definition of a privacy? If we just have a general definition, it's a company who is standing between the ultimate registrant and the Whois database and inserting their name instead of the actual registrant. How do we differentiate between domains by proxy, doing it for individual registrants, and companies like Mark Modern and CSC, which acquire domains for corporate customers who don't want their possession of that domain to be known at that time for a certain reason? Do we need to create a definition of who's going to have to be accredited?
I've got a more fun question. James, if we turn things on their head and you start off with a privacy proxy server and then they go shopping for a registrar, your enforcement model means you're going to have to take an awful lot of registrars to court for one problem. Because one privacy proxy server has got all those RAAs, and you're working through the RAA. That'll be fun.
Well, I think generally that's why we don't favor that model, because it doesn't allow for the independent... Yeah. Another option would be, for example, for large, well-respected and mature privacy service to offer its services to other registrars so that they can be added in its cart for registrars who really don't want to develop the service on their own.
Do they sign a contract with ICANN?
You're credited by
ICANN. Because the enforcement we're talking about is through a contract, is through the RAA.
That's why we're not in favor of that model. One of the 3,700 reasons why.
Hello, everyone. Yeah, I snuck in this afternoon, so I'm a little bit late, and I apologize for that. There's a lot of questions that I would like to... give a few words to. First, yes, I do believe that law firms that give privacy service in some form would have to be accredited as a privacy service to be able to offer that service. That has been part of our discussions all along. It's not yet consensus, but I think that there's sizable support for that idea. Another just brief comment is that in our experience, we deal with a lot of resellers because a large percentage of our registrar business is done through resellers. Some resellers have their own privacy services, so if they offer their privacy services as a reseller, they would be accredited for the privacy service and then could offer that through their registrar. That knows that this privacy service is accredited. For example, we also have resellers that operate through multiple registrars and have a privacy service in place. That would then be accredited, and they could go through multiple registrars if they wanted to. That business, that model is already in place in the reseller world. There's just no accreditation model for the privacy service that that reseller is offering, and that has been a demand, and we're looking at how to answer that demand in this working group. And finally, there's a similar model already in place, which is the accreditation of registrars with the new GTLD registries, where every registrar has to be TMCH accredited or certified to be able to offer registration service in the new GTLDs during the claims, at least during the claims phase. I think that can be compared in some way to the model that that the privacy service then would be facing, because it's the certification is not another accreditation, but it's a requirement by ICANN, and it's something that ICANN enforces as well. So maybe that's an alternative model that we also should look at.
Does anybody else have any other questions, comments? Okay. Thank you for your comments, by the way, Volker. And, we will definitely...
Just one more comment. sorry. If I'm not making any sense, that's a lack of sleep, 48 hours.
No, you were surprisingly clear today. No.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So one of the other issues that we've been thinking about is how these models would impact privacy proxy customers. And with respect to the registrar model, one of the points that's sort of obvious is that customers would potentially have more service provider options because a provider wouldn't necessarily have to be affiliated with a registrar, so anyone could gain accreditation. And the vetting of these services could potentially be more robust if ICANN is doing the screening and it's a full application process and everything. But on the flip side, the accreditation process could potentially cost more if there's a really extensive screening process, and these costs could be passed down to customers ultimately. So just one issue that we thought about. And also there's a risk of service disruption in the event that the privacy proxy service is de-accredited. And we've already talked a little bit about that and our thoughts about that. But with the reseller model, one of the customer impacts that we've thought about or see is that if they have a problem with the service, they have more places to go. They could go to a registrar or to ICANN with a complaint. And in the event that the service is terminated or they want to transfer services, there would be less friction or risk in transferring. And the escrow model is sort of a mix of both of those. There would be more more screening by ICANN and more oversight on ICANN's part, but there would also be more, or it could potentially ease the transition process. So, Wendy?
Wendy Seltzer, a question. So it's certainly possible that there would be more screening by ICANN. It's also possible that ICANN could choose not to enforce a contract, and other than sort of ICANN's interest in enforcing that contract, I'm not sure why the sort of end user should be relying on that.
Thanks, Wendy. Phil?
Phil Corwin for the transcript. How does, thinking about when a registrar is deaccredited, I don't know how ICANN chooses which registrar to do the bulk transfer to, but I know there's obviously some procedure, but it seems to me if we're going to have an accreditation model and the possibility for privacy proxy services with the possibility of deaccreditation, you have to create a similar system where if a provider is suddenly deaccredited, there's got to be a way to transfer all the domains to another accredited provider. You can't just leave all the registrants without anyone to communicate with or reveal all their data suddenly. So I think we have to build that into whatever we're discussing as well.
Thanks, Phil. This is Mike again, and I'll confess that's one of the things that drives a lot of our considerations in this, if not the primary thing, you know, is how do we make sure that registrants will be okay in the event of termination or failure. In the case of registrar termination, we have one thing working for us, and that's that registries know every domain name that every registrar has. But in the case of a registrar with a proxy or privacy service, which isn't affiliated with it, that registrar might not know if this is a proxy or privacy customer unless there's some mechanism by which that proxy or privacy service has had to identify to the registrar, you know, hey, I'm registering this as a proxy or privacy service, which, when we look at the three models, one way that we've sort of thought about it is the registrar model is sort of that everybody can come, everybody can apply, and the registrars are potentially sort of stuck with this world of potential proxy services, some of whom they might not wish to deal with, where in the reseller model, we think it's almost like the registrars are choosing who they want to partner with in terms of the proxy or privacy services, and the same with the escrow model, which allows a little bit more of a streamlined implementation. So registrars can have, for example, they may have some API that they develop based on their reseller API, or they may even just say to the proxy or privacy services, great, you're in our reseller program, this is how it works. But, so we're on the record our first concern is what happens to the customers in the event something happens to the proxy or privacy service.
Steve?
Yes, Steve Metallitz. Mike, just picking up on one thing you mentioned. We have discussed that in this. We have discussed in this working group how to identify whether it's a proxy registration. We've said our preliminary conclusion was domain name registrations involving privacy proxy service providers should be clearly labeled as such and who is. There may be various ways to implement this recommendation, and it goes on from there. So it should be possible for the registrar to know that this is a privacy proxy registration, and therefore to know whether it's dealing with an accredited service provider, and therefore know whether it is in compliance with its RAA obligations. You're right, though, that they don't know the whole universe. Unlike what a registry knows about a registrar, the registrar would not know the whole universe of registrations that party was engaged in.
Thanks, Steve. Mike again. And, that's a good point. The concern is, what about the people who don't do what they're supposed to? having lived through Register Fly, I'm always sort of thinking about what's the worst bad actor going to do to us, because that's probably going to be the big embarrassing one. So, we're always sort of thinking about that is, I don't want to say the worst case scenario, but, what might be the most challenging scenario for us to try and clean up?
All right. You can move on to the next slide. And most of the issues actually on the next couple of slides we've already touched on, so I can go through those relatively quickly. With respect to impacts on other stakeholders, and we've already touched on this, with respect to the registrar model, the RAA model, parties with complaints about privacy proxy services compliance or lack thereof with the requirements for being a service would have to go to ICANN. Whereas with the reseller and the escrow models, parties would potentially have more than one place to go. They could go to the registrar as well. And with respect to enforcement powers, ICANN's enforcement powers generally, the way it works with the RAA is that they can terminate a registrar, but they can't necessarily force or require specific performance or a relay or a reveal. It would be more about terminating the contract, so a person with a concern might not necessarily get the relief that they would really want coming to ICANN. So that's just one thought that we had about it. Okay. And with respect to the impact on registrars, we see, or in just talking about these different models, with the registrar model, we see for registrars less flexibility in the terms that they could have for privacy proxy services, just because the contract will be with ICANN and, you know, all the terms will be in there. And with the reseller model, there'll be more flexibility and potentially more discretion about which services they want to work with. In the escrow model, again, the terms could be limited by the ICANN approval process, but the relationship part of it could be more on the registrar's terms. So. And with respect to the impact on ICANN, with the registrar model, on ICANN's side, there would be costs associated with coming up with an application and a process, and also the ongoing account management and compliance enforcement piece. And with the reseller model, there would also be the compliance costs, but the startup costs would be a little lower because there wouldn't be the whole application screening process that there would be for the RAA-type model. And the escrow model, there would be similar to the registrar model, the contracting and application and screening costs, and also the compliance costs. So, and that's it for our slides. So if you guys have questions, comments.
So this is Mike. I have a comment. So we've had, three or four policy or sets of policy recommendations come through implementation since the advent of the implementation review team. And there doesn't seem to be particularly strong interest in being on implementation review teams, at least not relative to the policymaking working groups. And I just sort of want to flag that this is all implementation stuff that is, you know, is really, you know, I think near to a lot of people's hearts. And so when the call goes out to join the implementation review team, you know, please keep in mind the interest in these things, you know, is probably still going to be there. But if you're moving on to the next thing, you're not participating in that, you sort of lose some opportunities to have a voice in that. And I said that diplomatically. I don't mean it as a criticism at all. It's really, it's not always as glamorous, but it is important, and that was my point.
I will take the opportunity to make one final comment. As a member of an implementation team, let's talk about that offline. Because there may be a chicken-egg deal going on here. Any event, I really appreciate the presentation. Very helpful in both understanding what you're looking at, and at least in my case, prompted some thoughts about some ways we might approach some of the issues we've been looking at and will look at. So thanks also for ending right about that on time. And see you on some of the calls.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Have a nice weekend.
Say that again.
Do the latecomer introduction I forgot to do before introducing these folks.
Shall we do that now?
I know people who talk to the FBI all the time.
Long we'll be done, and there'll be no time left.
Sure. Okay, so before we move to the next agenda item, can I please ask those that have not been here from the very beginning to briefly introduce themselves to the group? Volker, can I ask you to kick this off?
Yes, of course. My name is Volker Greimann. I am a member of the GNSO Council and member of this working group and in severe need of sleep.
Hi, I'm Kieran Malacharyville. I am here representing Mark Monitor. Under this nursing cover is Lily Malacharyville, representing babies.
True.
Yeah, the future of ICANN, the youngest stakeholder. Anything else you need from me about me?
That's okay.
Yeah, member of the working group.
Hi, my name is Phil Morano. I work with Kat and Mush and Rosenman, and I'm with the ITC.
Well, do we have? I think Wendy.
Wendy Seltzer, here from the with the non-commercial stakeholders group and participant in the working group, who unfortunately has a standing call that conflicts with the working group's phone calls, but try to stay up to date.
Thanks, Wendy. Now, we have on the agenda now discussion of other questions identified during the day that require further discussion. I would like to take the liberty of prescribing what the open questions are. So, if I may, I'd like to suggest that we spend the first half of this session to discuss the language that Mary has put into the Adobe and circulated by email since that has to do with the relay issue. It's only like 4 or 5 lines. So if you could please take a look at that briefly. So I pause for 1 minute or two for you to go through this. But I think it would be excellent if we could take away a language that everybody is more or less comfortable with.
Sorry, what language are we looking at?
Mary has sent an email to the list at 1:07, subject summary of working group 10 October morning session. So you got permission now to look at the email, which is also on the screen.
Thanks, my Adobe was being slow to update.
Steve.
Yep, Steve Metallitz. I think this draft approaches this from a different angle than I would approach this point. Because it talks about what the service provider, it talks about the service providers, forwarding hard copy and so forth. I think the first point is that the service provider should notify the complainant when there has been a certain undeliverable, because there's been a certain minimum number of hard bounces within a certain specified time frame. That's point one. Now maybe that's not necessary because, as I mentioned, there's this whole point about having a contact. We've already agreed that there should be a contact for escalation and questions, but I think it's helpful to have this an explicit requirement. And second, this kind of puts it all on the service provider, and I thought that we were talking about that if the complainant is informed that the message hasn't gotten through, then it's on the complainant to say to the service provider, we want you to do something additional. I'm not saying a service provider can't do something additional, but in terms of a minimum standard, I think it's tell the complainant or the requester, and the requester can then ask the service provider to do something extra, and then we get into these issues of the cost and the fee. But That I think it might be a better way to approach this, rather than saying the service provider has to do something and take alternative means, whether or not the requester asks them to do it. Thanks.
David Hughes. So maybe just for 30 seconds, let's take a scenario of this escalation. So the first thing that that would happen from our side is, if there was contact information that we could use, obfuscated email or however it works through the proxy service, we could send that. Let's assume that nothing happens. So then we contact Abuse Desk or a web page or however we go through, and we send it again. And in each step here, I think what we need to do is we need to get feedback, because if we don't know whether the message was relayed or not, if it bounced back or was ignored, how do we know to, you know, how can we make an informed decision about asking them to escalate? If we got information back that said, yeah, we sent the email, it bounced, but we have other information, and we say, well, if you have other information, if there's a fax number, forward the PDF to their fax number, or, you know, send them something through physical mail, and sort of escalate it back up. But with each step, if there's no feedback loop of information, then from our side, how do we request the next step? We wouldn't know to. And as Steve said, I don't think it's reasonable to assume that the service provider is going to escalate on their side. Why would they if it's not coming as a request from us? Does that make sense?
And I think Mary is, or Marika is revisiting the draft as we move on. Any further comments?
I suppose what I was thinking is if you do it in chronological order, I don't know if that makes it easier for people to understand that when this happens, then this is what we expect to get back from the service provider, and depending on that, then we could request escalation to the next level or something like that.
I'm just looking at the chat here, and I misspoke. It would, from what Todd has said in there, that yeah, it'd be notifying the complainant or the requester, whatever we're calling that person, and then if the requester wants it, then this some alternative means of trying to reach the customer.
Holly.
I should finally identify myself, Holly Raish. In the fourth line, provided there's been a certain minimum number of hard bounces, well, we actually haven't put that in there. We've used in the first sentence probably a more accurate term, simply that it was undeliverable. Now, we're not saying how or why. We're basically saying it wasn't. Well, for some reason, it was undeliverable, and I think we ought to continue that language. Or alternative language is if the service provider becomes aware that the message was not delivered, something that picks that up. James has got a comment.
So I prefer the phrase delivery failure or delivery has failed rather than undeliverable, I think. And I'm struggling to think why I feel that way or articulate that. I think it's because undeliverable seems to be just a kind of a capitulation to something is impossible versus an acknowledgement that it could be a temporary situation, could be an error somewhere in the, you know, in the pipes, but basically that the delivery attempts had failed is more specific. And I do agree that definition of that maybe doesn't belong in the second sentence, but I do think that the concept is something that everyone seemed to be, you know, that it wasn't one strike, you're out, that there was some threshold that had to be established.
Any further comments on the language as it stands, David?
So, again, speaking as, but I don't know if I'm the only member of the mailing of the working group that's actually tried to actually run an email server. Speaking again, the idea that there will always be a hard bounce is not necessarily true. There's plenty of reasons why something could fail to be delivered for technical reasons that do not result in a hard bounce. I mean, there are a lot of poorly configured mail servers out there, and some of them, for example, may be so poorly configured that they are incapable of properly sending the hard bounce back out. In that, so I think we would be unwise to rely on that, which then leads us into the problem of an email that is not delivered and does not send a bounce back is, from the point of view of the outside world, indistinguishable from one that has been delivered and not acted on in any way. So we may be, maybe we really have to sort of, when it comes down to it, realize that we cannot 100% distinguish between undelivered and unacted upon mail, and put some way in here that we can, it may be just for after, no response has been given for some number of days or something, may have to be in there as a sort of catch for the case when no bounce or undeliverable notice has ever been put out.
But I think, David, we've limited it to the service provider becoming aware of that. So if, but I have James, Kathy, and Don.
So I just want to put this on the table because it's something we were chatting about over lunch, which is that this approach, I think the way we've discussed it thus far, centralizes all of those relay requests with the service provider and then expects them to be able to detect delivery failures, which, as we discussed, could be problematic, whereas by providing a unique, there's another approach would be for a service provider to provide a unique relay email address for each domain name and have that be a one-way channel, and then that would immediately deliver any bounce back or delivery failures, if they were received, to David's point, back to the complaining person. I think that would satisfy the notification requirement and the bounce simultaneously and leave the service provider out of the loop as far as detecting which bounce went with which relay request. So that would be check the box. We're done. Okay.
Kathy.
Agree with James. That makes sense. I don't think we can mandate implementation, but it sounds like a good implementation model that some proxy privacy providers are already providing, which is that link to an email that then forwards on to the customer's actual email. That all makes sense.
But it's a two-way, so that the bounce doesn't go to the provider.
It just goes back.
Right back to the...
Which is perfect.
Yeah.
And to David's point, I don't think we can boil the ocean completely.
Yeah.
I think we have to kind of deal with what we've got in light of the fact that we also have this seeming consensus that lack of a response is something that someone's entitled to as well.
So it looks like we have a solution that everybody might be happy with, only that this solution is impacting implementation. The question now is, how brave is this group? The GNSO community at times has complained that ICANN staff has stepped over the line with its toe by doing policy in the implementation process. So do you want to return the favor with this and prescribing implementation? I mean, you can always phrase things in a way that's technology neutral. But I think that what we have here, combined with what James just said, might do the trick, right? So that technical means shall be deployed that provide for request or notification in case notification fails. I mean, you don't have to talk about hard bounces or prescribe how things should be implemented. James.
Can we, I think Steve was in the queue, but I was just wondering, can we add something about explicitly say either relay the bounce notification or otherwise notify? I just want to allow for the possibility that notification might be just passing that back.
Steve.
This is Steve Mattel. It's Thomas. I think your formulation may be a very good one, which is that it should be set up in a way so that the requester becomes aware when of delivery failures, and when that happens, the requester should be able to ask the provider to make an attempt through another means to deliver the message. So that's technology neutral in the sense that it could either be set up the way James is talking about, or if it's set up differently, you know, through a web form, through something in which you wouldn't automatically, the requester wouldn't automatically be aware of a delivery failure, then it's on the service provider to tell the requester about that. But I think your formulation was right. Thank you.
Kathy. Kathy, I thought you had raised your hand.
I have.
Wendy.
Wendy Seltzer, wondering if we are talking about relaying notice of delivery failure, that we be careful that that not turn into a reveal by relaying the actual bounce message that includes details of underlying server configurations and other details of the
right.
registrant.
Yeah, I mean, that's the responsibility of the proxy service to provide a proxy for their customers, to protect their customers' identity. So if they're a good proxy service, they won't reveal.
The automated bounce, of course, assumes that each and every domain registration gets an individual email. I've seen a lot of proxy services or law firms acting as proxy service that use a general purpose email address and then do it manually. I just don't want to hard code something into the language that takes out certain business models that make sense. Or
but we could leave the original language as alternative language to this, so that the service provider can either do it, you know, upon getting aware of delivery failures.
It makes no difference to us if it's an automated process, which makes sense for James's big company, or doesn't make sense for, you know, somebody's small law firm. It doesn't matter to us as long as the result is the same.
And one more comment from my side. I would really like to see the hard copy out disappear from this draft and just have other alternative methods of communications, i.e. because if we leave the hard copy as a in the draft, it might sneak into the implementation in a way that is not foreseen with this group. So it would be included in the alternative form of communication, but I'd rather not see it here because a lot of private services explicitly exclude forwarding of hard copy, and with good reason.
Let me just explain, Volker. This came up earlier today in the sense of forwarding a hard copy of an electronic communication, not necessarily forwarding a request that came in via paper.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. Didn't we also talk about returning a hard copy of a delivery failure?
No.
I don't believe so, not today.
This is David, but
that
that's a great idea. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm not clear on, okay.
This is David Volker. So what we said was, if we sent a notice in a PDF, for example, then you could electronically transmit it to a fax machine, or you could print it out and put it in an envelope and mail it. In most cases, now there may be some jurisdictions where an actual signed or notarized physical copy has to be sent or something, but I mean, in those cases, people are going to do that anyway, so...
Well, speaking for the privacy service that we operate, we will certainly not forward any hard copy. That's an additional cost that is certainly not part of our calculation, and we will not have, even if you were offering to pay for that, that's not something that our business model currently allows, that we accept payments from other parties directly for the privacy service provider. So it's a bit problematic to have hard copy in there if there's other means of communications available.
So this is David again. So the conversation we had this morning was, if your customers maintain their contact information correctly, it will not get escalated to this level. So you could consider passing those charges on to your customer.
And so this is, I think, something that Thomas and I were discussing at lunch, is we have to be very wary of any mechanism that has an asymmetrical cost structure, to where that the cost burdens are absorbed by party that's not benefiting from the mechanism. And I think that goes both for the customer and for the complainant. So I think that we have to be careful. Economically, whenever something's free, it's going to be abused. You know, and so it even if it's a negligible cost recovery, I think that will help to ensure that these types of relay requests are valid and legitimate. But I'm curious as to why this escalation to a hard copy relay of physical or postal or whatever we want to call it, why that's part of this electronic. I mean, isn't that two separate? I mean, you could start there if the privacy service offered that. You wouldn't be required to send it electronically. I don't know. Let me just noodle on that one for a little bit. I was thinking of them as two atomic processes, not that one was the escalation of another.
And this is David again. And the other thing, James, is that I can't speak for all of the IPC group, but I think, I personally think that it would be reasonable for us to, and we discussed this morning that, you know, law firms have standard ways of calculating pages per copy and all that other stuff, that those are the kind of fees that we would consider absorbing if, I suppose the quid pro quo here is that if we're getting feedback on the electronic notifications so that we are in a position to decide, okay, in this case, it's worth it for us to spend money to reimburse you to send a physical delivery. Does that make sense?
James, I guess the question was for you.
Yeah, it makes sense. We'll have to think about this one a little bit, particularly the fee structure, because here's what I'm thinking is, if I have made a good faith effort to relay something and the email address is not functional, now I have to question whether the postal address is valid. And before I start, anyway.
Kieran.
So I think I was on maternity leave when most of this discussion happened, because it's not familiar to me yet. So this is more like a question to the group. In the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, I was under the impression that if there's, you know, reasonable evidence that an email address is non-functional, or the who is contact information in general is thought to be inaccurate, that the registrar then has to make a reasonable effort to verify that information. Was there any discussion about that being the standard for providers, and if so, why aren't we using that standard instead? Why are we reinventing the wheel here?
Steve, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, both in those earlier conversations, and then again we talked about this morning. That requirement is passed through to the. We've recommended that requirement be passed through to the service providers, but in this situation, I don't think we want to rely solely on that, because again, under the RAA, that's a protracted process. It could easily take several weeks for that verification process to happen. So, if there's another way that we can try to get the information to the customer, or relay the message to the customer, let's do it. But it's not an either or. It's a both and.
Okay, so I understand that James and others will need to think more about the language. I think we're very close to reaching agreement on that. You know, certainly this is not a consensus call, but I think that we should leave it here for everybody to further think about it and discuss with your respective groups, and then you will pick it up during one of your next meetings. Is that okay, or does anyone of you want to make final remarks on that? No? which is why I would then like to use the remainder of the time to get back to the reveal discussion. I need to check with Marika, how much time will you need to do the overall assessment thing? Okay, so let's take like 15 minutes to maybe sketch out the next steps on how to approach reveal. And Kathy, you wanted to...
The comment doesn't have to do with it. I just thought I'd let everyone know, since we've all been in this room for a while, that there's alcohol being set up out there. And I don't know if it's for us, but I was glad to see it.
Can I suggest applause for Glenn at this point?
Yeah. But you will only get access to the booze if we reach agreement on reveal. No, seriously, you're
going to get a couple of burnt wood messages from some of them.
Where do we go with reveal? I wasn't joking when I said that time flew when we had the session. You know, some of you wanted to dive into some very specific scenarios, and, you know, the session was over before we even had talked about the fundamental principles that would be applicable to all the scenarios. I think that we've made progress on eliminating some of the stuff that we want to keep out of the conversation, like law enforcement requests that were sometimes mixed with other types of requests. But then I think for this group to make good progress, we mustn't get lost in detail, because everybody around the table has their specific agendas and requests, wishes for the reveal situation. So I think for the initial report, the best you can do is maybe to come up with some very high-level approaches to things. And I think these high-level approaches can be some that we've discussed earlier, and I'm not going to repeat them now. But as far as trademark, copyright, and other reveal requests are concerned, maybe they should be as superficial as saying a request must be sufficiently detailed to allow for the to give the opportunity to the privacy and proxy service provider to establish whether an infringement is present or not. And then to give opportunity to the beneficiary owner to respond to that request, set a certain time span for the response. And we heard somebody suggesting 7 days response. And then based on the response or the lack of response, you know, I would maybe use the word, should there be no sufficient response from the beneficiary owner, then the privacy and proxy service provider would be entitled to reveal to the requesting party, which would be a disclosure and not a publication, which I think improves the situation opposed to the status quo significantly. And I'd like to emphasize what James was saying earlier, that at present, in most such cases, when a complaint is coming in, the only thing that would happen is termination of the agreement and publication. So if you reduce this to disclosure to the requesting party, I think that would be a significant step forward, wouldn't it? And then maybe another basic clause or recommendation whereby you say that this is notwithstanding any termination rights that the service provider might have. So if the service provider might face liability by keeping up a site or not revealing, then these termination rights that might be in the terms and conditions should remain unaltered from this. So what I'm trying to say is, I think you can't find entirely specified approaches for all types of infringements that are workable in all jurisdictions around the world. I think the best you can do in this group, at least for the initial report, is to spell out such basic principles and maybe get some community feedback on that. James.
So the one thing that we were missing was the discussion about having a account-based or, you know, user-based system for reveal requests, so that the authentication of requesters for reveal requests. And then the concern that I have about allow for the customer to respond to whom? To the provider, or to the requester? I actually would say something like for the customer to take action, to remedy, to cancel, do we want to list the potential actions? I think, you know, I'm concerned about respond, because it begs other questions like respond with what and respond to whom. That maybe we're going too far into detail for the high-level principles, but otherwise I would say for the customer to take action.
I thought that we had agreed on the need for authentication mechanism for requesting parties. I haven't repeated that, but yeah. And I thought that was common sense, and I've just not repeated.
Oh, I'm sorry, but it wasn't in your list, so
right.
I...
James just wanted on the record.
I haven't looked at that list, sorry.
Fine, sorry. And then maybe someone can help me with, we're giving them a window to do what?
I think that's up for the group to decide. I think sufficient response would be an appropriate thing, but that's certainly...
To respond appropriately, or respond or take appropriate action, something like
and you
that.
You can even establish a back channel for the beneficiary owner to respond to the, you know, without disclosing, to respond to the requesting party. So maybe...
So the reveal process falls back to the relay process?
Yeah, but if that fails, then you could reveal. I'm not trying to suggest a solution here, but just, you know, I think I had Kathy first, wasn't it? Kathy, had you raise your hand? And then I get to Paul.
As long as we're listing off points, and this is actually pulling something in from a Tuesday discussion, and also from Steve's draft, probably a last bullet point would be, or an additional bullet point would be, subject to limitations on the use of the disclosed information. So you can't put it on your blog.
Mm-hmm. So Wendy was first, and then Paul?
Wendy Seltzer. I think leaving a broad category of potential actions under that responsive action is useful. It could be a customer taking action to take down the website and clear up the reason for complaint. It could be filing a motion to quash in a local relevant jurisdiction and giving notice of that to the provider. And there might well be other things that would satisfy the provider and or the requester.
Thanks, Wendy. Paul?
So after complaining that we never got down the track, I feel like y'all all got on the train but when I was still in the gift shop. And trying to catch up. I hate to say this, but this would have been a great conversation like 3 hours ago. I don't know. For example, we have a word like provider may proceed to disclose. What does that mean? Must? Is it must? You know, I just don't think we're going to be able to accomplish several hours worth of work in 11 minutes. I think it's fine that we're having this conversation, but this is definitely one that we're going to, whatever comes out of this 12-minute sprint, so that we can appear to have, accomplished good stuff in this space today. We're going to have to, take it back and think about it. So I just don't want everybody to walk away from this thinking, "Yay, we're done," because I think that this is important and it has to be thought through. Thank you. Bye.
And this goes back to the opening remarks when we said that, you know, everything that we're going to do here needs to be taken back by all working group members to their respective groups. But the intention was just to try to capture the interim results, and certainly you have to take it back, take it forward from this. Steve, was that, no, I have Volker first, and then Steve, I think you wanted to speak. Volker?
Yeah, having not been present at the earlier discussion, I might have missed the salient points where we all sat together and sang Kamvaya, but I would be very cautious in having an automated process where you put in X at the top and after clunking down the chain of events, then Y or Z comes out at the end. First of all, the provider in 90% of the cases is not qualified, neither legally nor competently, to determine the facts of the matter and to determine the quality or accuracy of the complaint. We receive dozens of complaints. He has stolen my picture. He has stolen my text from my web page. How are we to quantify that? How are we to verify that? It's there's a lot of complaints that we as providers simply cannot make a judgment on. And then we would be still be forced to disclose if he doesn't respond to the complainant. A response to the complainant would mean that either we would have to forward something, or he would reveal his email address to the complainant directly if we say he has to respond to that. I think if the other party contacts us to say, this is harassment, they should go away, I have nothing to do with this, this is okay what I'm doing, and this is believable, and that might be a result as well. I just want to be cautious here that we don't want to have a fixed result just because there is a complaint, because the merits of the complaint cannot be seen on the face of it in most cases.
I think we had Steve next, and then Kieran.
Well, this is Steve Metallitz. I was going to second what Paul said, that let's not let the train get ahead of itself, but I think Volker has now made that comment kind of unnecessary. But I think this is useful as kind of a template for maybe the level of detail we should be striving for. There's stuff that comes before this, which is what are the requisites of a complaint that would meet this threshold. This is what we tried to provide as an example for intellectual property issues. So we still have to kind of decide that. And then obviously there's a lot of bracketed things in here as well. I think this is useful, Thomas, as far as kind of a general framework for how where we might want it to end up in terms of detail. I'm leaving aside the question of whether we also want to give illustrative examples or work on some use cases and kind of see how this works, and maybe, you know, incorporate that in some way. But I think it's helpful to have this, and I think there are obviously a number of issues that still need to be worked out.
Thanks, Steve. Kathy?
Given that we were talking about all these different categories, law enforcement, abuse, defamation, it seems to me the intro to this section might be, and correct me if I'm wrong, would be for an intellectual property complaint stated with great specificity, including, and here I'm just trying to summarize what you had, Steve, including the identification of the intellectual property owner, the intellectual property, the infringement, and I would add, and the representative who's making the complaint, because it may be a lawyer. So that's the introduction to this category, because we did agree that these points don't apply to everything, and they certainly don't apply to law enforcement, and we haven't really gotten into abuse and the special cases involving abuse. So happy to read that back. Did that sound right or wrong to people for the broad brush that we're doing?
I think that's helpful, Kathy. Kieran?
So, yeah, I guess being at the end of a long day, this might come across as a little confused, but I agree with Volker, shocker, that it's impossible. I know. is this transcribed? I'm screwed. But the asking the provider or really anybody, and I think I've said this before, to make a decision on the face of a complaint is just a really bad idea. Whether the result of that is that the provider has to force a disclosure, which is not ideal for their customer, or whether they're going to deny relay or whatnot as a result of making a determination on the face of a legal complaint. So I think it's really important when we put high-level standards in place that we're not saying that a determination should be made by the provider, but rather that, maybe there's a prima facie case that's made by the complainant. But I think then that raises the question about that the registrant needs to respond. And there's been a lot of discussion about, well, they have the right not to. And, certainly they do have the right not to, people have the right to ignore whatever they want to ignore to a point, right? And maybe in the terms of services for the use of these kinds of services, we say, you have to respond. Because if you're not responding to the request, then we are going to say that a prima facie case has been made. Because if they just have the right not to respond, then we're at a loss on our end. What do we do next? There's no next step for us. If there's no response and they have the right to do that, and then there's no due process for us on our side of it. So there's a lot of really complicated factors with this. So boiling it down to these bullet points is making me really uncomfortable, I guess. So I guess it all circles back to Paul's comment. Thanks.
Thanks, Kira. Don?
Just real briefly, just another situation where the model we're focusing on may be different in the abuse area. It's relatively, obviously if you have somebody who knows what to look at, it's really very relatively simple to verify whether there's any merit to an abuse complaint. I can do it in about 5 minutes or less. So, again, we've got a situation where our models may be different, and then the question is how much we have to account for the different ones or just come up with a high-level description, high-level principles.
Thanks, Don. I have Volker and then Steve, and then we have to call it a day.
Kieran, that must be the cause of both of us being young parents now, so that may be behind it. But I agree that there must be due process in some form, and that's something that I tried to address in the draft I sent around last week or this week. Where I said that maybe good faith belief might not be enough, but a sworn statement that we could take to court that the complainant is willing to stand by in court if it comes to that and be sued about and sued for damages might be sufficient for a cause of action that the provider can rely on.
Steve.
Yeah, this is Steve. So, Volker, since your plane was delayed, so we had some discussion about my proposal or the proposal I put forward, and we were going to get into responses to yours, so we didn't really get a chance to do that. Let me just say very briefly that I think there's a lot of overlap. I think that your last point, we did address that with a statement under penalty of perjury. That may not mean exactly the same thing as what you're talking about, but I think it's somewhere in the same on the same terrain. I think the main concern that we had, that I had with your edits was kind of in the general policy paragraph where you really just kind of flipped everything we said on its head. I think we can get beyond that because I think that, there really is a fair amount of commonality and with some additional elements that have been brought in here. I appreciate you getting us such a quick response on that. Number one, number two, I think it was constructive. So let's keep moving from there. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. And with that, I think our conversation for today is more or less over, or we continue the conversation over wine and beer.
I have promised to reserve the last 10-15 minutes for Marika to do the evaluation part, because as you know, this pilot is to be examined, assessed. I think you shouldn't be frightened by the level of simplicity of these bullet points. I mean, this was clearly meant to condense down the very complex discussion to some points that you can work on, and you can put all the detail in it that you want to, if you can, if you reach agreement on them. But I think that with this exercise, maybe we've achieved to narrow this down to some principles that you can further work on. With that, I think my facilitation role for today is over. It's been a very interesting and informative day. I think thank you all for your valuable contributions. So I hand back over the mic to Marika, Don, whoever. Thanks.
So this is Marika. You want to go first?
No, let me just a couple of comments, and then people do evals and go drink. Just real quickly, this has been an excellent experience, I think. I just want to make a couple of suggestions for moving forward. Obviously, what we've come up with today, there's a lot of people who weren't here. So we'll want to, you know, get feedback from them. There were a couple comments toward the end here about there are points we didn't touch. And I'd really appreciate if there's things you think we need to follow up with, you know, let us know. Send email to the list, to the chair group, whatever, so that we know what we need to follow up on here. Because that's what's going to make this exercise complete. We're still working on timetable for moving forward. This is going to be a lot. Fortunately, there's no call next week, so you won't have to worry about templates by then. But I'd like to just impress that we're not done here. We're not done with today's work, and we probably won't be for at least a couple of weeks. So to the extent you're going to be discussing what we talked about, I would hope that, and I probably will be, but I think it'd be best to discuss what we talked about, the topics that came up, and try to avoid characterizing the discussions, and certainly avoid characterizing any conclusions, because fundamentally we don't have any yet. Just a request. Now for the paperwork.
Yeah, so this is Rika. So indeed, before you get to the booze, there's a little bit of homework to do. So first of all, I want to all thank you for, you know, taking part in the day and, you know, spending your day here inside, even with a little bit of light outside. But for us, it's really important to get some feedback on what your experience was, not only from the perspective of, you know, the meeting today and how that can be improved, but also in the overall context of how this may help PDP working groups. Because as I think most of you know, this is part of a pilot project, so we'll be running similar meetings at the next meeting and the meeting thereafter, and at the end of that year, basically, we'll do an evaluation and have a discussion around whether this is something we should be continuing, you know, changing, modifying, stopping altogether. So I really would appreciate if you could just, you know, take a couple of minutes to fill this in, and then maybe we can still do a little brief round where just people, you know, state what they thought was useful, what they thought was less useful, what should we be improving, and you know, is this something worth considering, you know, implementing as a more kind of standard feature for PDP and working groups when needed. So I'll just hand out the forms, and then you get 5 minutes, and then maybe you can do a quick round if people just want to throw out some things, and then you can get drinks.
I've just done the same form on the mailing list as well for those that were participating remotely or had to leave early. So it's the same form, so people prefer to fill it in electronically. But the main reason why we're handing it out here, we often get a better response rate if we ask people to do it before they get drinks. Seems to work very well.
Have a wonderful weekend, all.
Thanks, Chris.
So as people are finished with their homework and wrapping up, maybe some people want to just, you know, share with us what they thought we should do more of, less of, what should we keep the same, any general comments people would like to share with the group.
Where'd the facilitator go?
Thomas is here. He thought this group was such a disaster that he just...
indicated that, you know, how can I give feedback? He made his introduction and then he was...
Yeah, no, he unfortunately, he was unwell and basically went back to
I didn't
bed.
Get that. I
no,
left.
And he was really sorry about that.
I thought we were so well behaved, he's like, my work here is done.
Exactly, he gave up, he gave up. Any other... comments people would like to share? Or
I'd like to give thanks to Mary and to Thomas. I thought you did an excellent job facilitating it.
All right, well, I think it's time for drinks with that. Thanks, everyone.